Imagine, if you will, a room full of people who are just deeply, deeply invested in the world of psychedelics.
Right, yeah. Like a conference or a retreat or something.
Exactly. And they're gathered in these small circles, holding coffees or, maybe something a bit more herbaceous.
Sure.
And they are passionately debating the distinct personalities of LSD versus psilocybin mushrooms. Like, they are really getting into it.
Oh, I can picture it perfectly. It's a very common debate.
Right. So on one side of the room, you have the LSD advocates, and they are describing this incredibly electric, sharp, highly cerebral marathon of an experience.
The way they talk about it, it's almost cybernetic, you know?
Yes. Cybernetic is the perfect word. It's often characterized as this outward-facing, energetic journey where, like, the edges of reality feel laser-cut.
Yeah, vibrating with this restless driving force.
Exactly. But then on the other side of the room, you have the mushroom proponents, and they're talking about an experience that sounds like it belongs on a completely different planet.
Oh, completely. It's night and day in how they describe it.
They describe a warm, emotional, highly introspective, earthy journey. I mean, one group makes it sound like the compound came from a sterile, high-tech laboratory.
Well, which it did.
Right, exactly. While the other group insists their compound feels like it came directly from the dirt, carrying the wisdom of the ancient
Yeah,
forest.
the popular cultural folklore surrounding these two substances is absolutely convinced that they are fundamentally different animals.
100%. But, and here is the multi-million dollar question we really need to consider today. What if the human brain just doesn't actually care about any of that folklore?
It is a phenomenal question,
Yeah.
and it really gets to the heart of why subjective human experience can sometimes be a terrible narrator of biological reality.
Yeah, because we build these narratives, right?
We do. We build these massive, towering narratives around how things feel. But those feelings are heavily colored by expectation, by the setting, by, I mean, decades of 1960s counterculture baggage.
So much baggage.
Exactly. But if we strip all of that away, if we drop the vibes, the anecdotes, the tie-dyed mythologies, and look strictly at the cold, hard neuroscience, a completely different picture emerges.
And that's what we're going to do. We're talking about analyzing the actual receptor binding profiles in a lab setting, right?
Right. Looking at data from rigorous double-blind clinical trials where the patients have absolutely no idea what they've been given.
And looking at high-resolution functional brain scans.
Exactly. Because when you rely on those metrics, the science reveals a truth about these two molecules that is, frankly, deeply counterintuitive.
And that is exactly our mission for this deep dive. We are looking at a very extensive, incredibly detailed article published just recently.
Yeah, in July 2026.
Right, July 2026, by the OOTW Journal. And the piece is titled Psilocybin versus LSD: The Neuroscience of the Two Classic Psychedelics.
It's a fantastic, comprehensive review.
It really is.
Yeah.
So the goal for you, if you are listening to this right now and trying to separate fact from fiction, is to understand precisely what separates these two archetypal molecules when they enter the human brain.
And honestly, more importantly, what fundamentally unites them.
Okay, let's unpack this, because if you want to be incredibly well informed on the current state of psychedelic neuroscience, without drowning in impenetrable academic jargon, consider this your ultimate cheat sheet.
Yeah, to truly understand these two titans of the classic psychedelic class, we have to start with the baseline biological foundation.
Right, the absolute basics.
We can't even begin to entertain the idea of how LSD and psilocybin differ until we look at the exact doorway they both use to enter the brain's operating
The
system.
doorway, the shared engine, as the article calls it.
Yes.
The shared engine. Because it makes a point to emphasize this right out of the gate. Under the hood, these two supposedly vastly different substances are actually running the exact same chemical engine.
They are. In neuropharmacological terms, both LSD and psilocybin are what we call serotonergic 5-HT2A receptor agonists.
Okay, wait, let's slow down and define that, because that is a mouthful for anyone who isn't a chemist.
Fair enough, yeah.
We hear about serotonin all the time in the context of, antidepressants or mood, but what does it actually mean to be a 5-HT2A agonist?
So serotonin is one of the primary neurotransmitters in the human brain. You can think of neurotransmitters as chemical messengers.
Like little postmen.
Exactly. Floating across the tiny gaps between brain cells to deliver instructions. And serotonin doesn't just do one thing. It plays into a wide variety of different receptors to regulate mood, digestion, cognition, perception, sleep.
It's a multipurpose tool.
It really is. However, there is one very specific subtype of serotonin receptor, the 5-HT2A receptor, That is the primary target here.
And what does the agonist part mean?
When a molecule acts as an agonist, it means it mimics the natural messenger.
Mm-hmm.
It fits into the receptor lock, turns the key, and activates it.
So LSD and psilocybin are essentially both acting as molecular imposters.
Yes.
They're pretending to be serotonin and specifically targeting this one type of lock. But the article points out that these 5-HT2A locks aren't just like scattered randomly throughout the entire brain, right?
No, no. The location is critical. They are densely expressed on what are known as layer 5 pyramidal neurons in the cortex.
Layer 5 pyramidal neurons. Okay, what makes those specific neurons so special?
Well, to picture this, think of the cortex, you know, the wrinkled outer layer of the brain that handles higher level processing, consciousness, complex thought.
Right, the part that makes us human, basically.
Exactly. Think of it as a layered cake. It generally has 6 layers. Layer 5 is situated deep within this structure.
Okay.
And it contains these massive cells called pyramidal neurons, named because their cell bodies literally look like little pyramids under a microscope.
Oh, that's actually kind of cute.
It is, yeah. Mm. But these neurons are the major output pathways of the cortex. They act like the brain's massive broadcasting towers.
Broadcasting towers. Okay, I like that visual.
They send long cables down into other regions of the brain, essentially dictating the flow of information. So when a classic psychedelic molecule binds to the 5-HT2A receptors on these specific broadcasting towers, it stimulates them intensely.
It basically turns the volume up to 11.
Way past 11.
Yeah.
It sets off a profound cascade of neural activity that changes the way the entire brain communicates with itself.
Okay, I understand the theory, but I have to ask, the brain is an incredibly noisy, complex system, right? With billions of intersecting pathways.
Billions, yes.
How do scientists know for an absolute certainty that this single specific receptor, the 5-HT2A, is the true engine of the psychedelic experience?
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't it be, you know, a combination of 50 different things happening at once?
That is a fundamental question. And it brings us to a crucial scientific anchor highlighted in the source material. It's a 2025 study by a researcher named Sharp and their team.
Right, the Sharp study.
Yeah. And this study is just a brilliant demonstration of applied pharmacology. Because in neuroscience, if you want to prove what a specific receptor does, you find a way to turn it off.
Okay, how do you do that?
Researchers can administer a drug called a highly selective 5-HT2A antagonist. If an agonist turns the key and opens the door, an antagonist does the exact opposite.
So it jams the lock like putting super glue into a keyhole.
That is a perfect analogy. The antagonist parks itself inside the receptor pocket. It doesn't activate the neuron, but it physically blocks anything else from getting in.
It just sits there taking up space.
Exactly. So what the Sharp study did was take human subjects and administer this antagonist, chemically gluing the 5-HT2A lock shut.
Okay.
And after they did that, they administered standard, fully active doses of either LSD or psilocybin.
And what happened?
Absolutely nothing.
Nothing at all.
Nothing. The subjective psychedelic effects of both drugs were completely abolished. The trip simply did not happen. The patients didn't see geometric patterns. They didn't have profound shifts in consciousness. They didn't feel the electric marathon or the earthy journey.
Because the door was glued shut.
Precisely. The molecule enters the body, reaches the brain, finds the specific layer 5 doors locked, and the entire cascade is stopped cold.
That is fascinating because it totally grounds the conversation. If you shut that one specific door, the entire mystical experience just vanishes.
It does. It elegantly proves that the 5-HT2A receptor is the indispensable primary driver of the classic psychedelic state. It is the shared root beneath every single surface difference we are going to discuss today.
Which actually brings up a really interesting chemical quirk about psilocybin that the article details. When we talk about psilocybin floating up to the cortex and opening that 5-HT2A door, we are technically using a misnomer, aren't we?
We are, yes.
Because psilocybin itself doesn't actually fit into the lock.
That is correct. Psilocybin is what pharmacologists refer to as a prodrug.
A prodrug. Meaning it's essentially a delivery vehicle, like a biological Trojan horse.
Exactly. The molecule known as psilocybin, which is what is primarily synthesized by the mushroom in the wild, is structurally very stable.
Which is great for the mushroom sitting out in a forest exposed to the elements.
Right, it protects the compound. But it's not the molecule that activates your brain. When you ingest psilocybin, your body immediately recognizes it and goes to work. The digestive system and enzymes in your liver rapidly strip away a phosphorus atom from the molecule.
So the body is actively disassembling the drug.
Yes, it is modifying it. This process is called the phosphorylation. And once that specific phosphorus group is clipped off, the psilocybin is converted into a structurally different molecule called psilocin.
Ah, psilocin, with an N.
Yes, psilocin is the actual active compound. That is the key that crosses the blood-brain barrier, travels up to the cortex, and hits those 5-HT2A receptors on the pyramidal neurons.
Which is a distinct metabolic difference from LSD, isn't it?
Oh, it is a major difference. LSD lysergic acid diethylamide requires no such biological conversion process.
It's just ready to go right out of the box.
Fully active, exactly as it is synthesized. It goes straight from ingestion to the receptor without needing the body's enzymes to alter its shape into an active form.
You know, if you're listening to this, you might assume that this difference, the body having to chemically process the mushroom compound but not the lab-created compound, is the reason they feel different.
It's a logical leap to make.
Right. But the article pushes past that. It leads to this massive, glaring question. If psilocin and LSD are essentially both just turning the exact same 5-HT2A key in the exact same biological lock, how on earth did they get such vastly different cultural reputations?
Right. Where does the folklore come from?
Yeah. Is the difference between the electric marathon and the earthy journey purely the placebo effect? Are people just experiencing what their friends told them they would experience?
Well, it's tempting to write it all off as cultural conditioning, but that wouldn't be scientifically accurate.
Okay, so there is a real difference.
Yes. While the core 5-HT2A key is the shared foundation, we have to look much closer at the physical shape and the behavior of the molecules themselves as they float through the brain. The OETW journal article explains this by introducing a pharmacological concept describing LSD as a much messier or much more promiscuous molecule.
Promiscuity in pharmacology. That is such a vivid term. So if the 5-HT2A receptor is the shared engine, you're saying the way these two molecules interact with other engines nearby is where their paths diverge.
Yes, exactly. When pharmacologists say a drug is promiscuous, they mean it has low selectivity. It doesn't just neatly bind to one single target and ignore everything else.
It's swiping right on everybody.
This is a very modern way to put it, but yes. It wanders around the brain and binds to a whole panel of different receptor types. LSD is notoriously promiscuous.
Okay.
Yes, its primary trip-inducing action happens at 5-HT2A, as the Sharp study proved. But it doesn't stop there. As it diffuses through the brain, it binds to a massive array of other serotonin receptors, 5-HT1A, 1B, 2C, 5, 6, and 7.
Wow, so a whole family of them.
And it also binds to adrenergic receptors, which are the receptors that respond to adrenaline and norepinephrine.
So it's triggering the adrenaline system alongside the serotonin system. No wonder it feels electric.
Right. But the article points out an even bigger departure. Dopamine.
Dopamine. Okay, that's huge.
Crucially, yes. LSD binds to dopamine receptors, specifically the D1, D2, and D3 subtypes. This is a massive structural departure from psilocin.
And dopamine is the neurotransmitter we constantly hear associated with, like, drive, energy, stimulation, reward.
Motivation, yes. The article actually cites historical pharmacological data going all the way back to a key researcher named Marona Lewicka in 2005. Her data suggested that LSD's interaction with the dopamine system, particularly the D2 receptor, is a primary factor in coloring the subjective experience.
Okay, so when you take a drug that powerfully activates dopamine receptors, you generally feel stimulated.
Exactly. That dopaminergic activity is widely believed to be the biological root of LSD's later phase character. It is what gives it that restless, energetic, stimulant-like, you know, electric quality that the folklore talks about.
It literally has a distinct stimulant pharmacology layered right on top of its psychedelic pharmacology.
Yes. It's doing two things at once.
How does that compare to our dephosphorylated mushroom compound, psilocin?
Psilocin is comparatively very well behaved.
It's loyal to its target.
Very loyal.
Yeah.
It is highly selective. It primarily sticks to a much tighter cluster of serotonin receptors, mainly 5-HT2A, 5-HT2C, and 5-HT1A.
No dopamine.
The source emphasizes that it has very weak and highly inconsistent dopaminergic and adrenergic activity. It just doesn't reliably trigger the brain's stimulant pathways. It has a much more purely serotonin-centric profile.
So when the mushroom advocates in our hypothetical room describe their trip as feeling heavier, maybe more sedating, more embodied, and distinctly lacking that sharp driving energy of the LSD trip, they aren't just making it up.
Not at all.
That subjective feeling aligns perfectly with the fact that psilocin isn't simultaneously hammering their dopamine and adrenaline systems.
The biology completely validates the feeling, yes. The promiscuity explains a significant portion of those vibe differences.
And here's where it gets really interesting, because the promiscuity of LSD is just one part of the puzzle. The article dives into something that sounds almost like microscopic engineering.
It really does.
We have to talk about the physical structure of the 5-HT2A receptor itself and the mind-blowing structural biology of how an LSD molecule actually fits into it, because this explains one of the greatest, longest-standing mysteries of LSD.
You're referring to the 2017 study by Wacker and colleagues.
Yes, the Wacker study.
In the field of neuropharmacology, this was a monumental breakthrough. For decades, scientists knew that LSD was extraordinarily potent. They knew it lasted an incredibly long time. But they couldn't see exactly why. They were basically operating blind.
Right.
Until the Wacker team used a technique called X-ray crystallography.
Okay, let's explain what that is. Because crystallizing a biological receptor sounds basically impossible. Receptors are squishy proteins floating in cell membranes, right? How do you crystallize something that is essentially organic jelly?
It is incredibly difficult. Proteins are dynamic, you know. They wiggle and move. To understand their exact shape, scientists have to coax these proteins into forming a rigid, repeating crystal structure, often at extremely low temperatures.
Okay, freezing them into place.
Essentially, yes.
Yes.
And then they blast them with X-rays. By measuring how the X-rays bounce off the crystal, computers can calculate the exact atomic-level three-dimensional shape of the protein.
Wow.
Yeah. And what the Wacker team managed to do was crystallize the human 5-HT2A receptor while a molecule of LSD was actively bound inside of it.
So they essentially took a molecular atomic-level photograph of the lock and the key engaged at the exact moment of activation.
That is exactly what they did.
And what they saw in that photograph sounds like science fiction.
It was entirely unexpected. They discovered that the 5-HT2A receptor has a specific structural component called extracellular loop 2.
Okay, what does that look like?
Well, think of the receptor as a deep pocket or a cavern on the surface of the cell. When the LSD molecule slips down into this binding pocket, this extracellular loop actually moves. It physically folds over the top of the LSD molecule like a biological lid.
It acts as a trap door.
Yes. Once the LSD molecule is nestled into the pocket, that amino acid lid closes shut over it, and the molecule is what we call kinetically trapped inside the receptor.
It's like, okay, it's like psilocin is a polite guest who walks through the automatic front doors of an office building, conducts their business at the front desk, says a pleasant hello, and promptly walks back out.
I love this analogy.
But LSD walks in, and the moment it crosses the threshold, the automatic doors slam shut, heavy steel grates come crashing down, and the entire building goes on absolute lockdown. It traps the guest inside the lobby for hours on end, constantly ringing the front desk bell.
That is a remarkably accurate analogy for what is happening at the atomic scale. The sheer physical mechanics of it are astounding, and the numbers the article provides to quantify this are just staggering.
How long does it stay trapped?
Because of this lid mechanism, the residence time, which is the scientific term for how long a single molecule stays bound to a single receptor for LSD on a standard wild-type 5-HT2A receptor, is an incredible 221 minutes.
Wait, wild-type? Is that a genetic term?
Oh, yes. My apologies. Wild-type simply means the standard, naturally occurring, unmutated version of a gene or a receptor as it exists in nature.
Okay, so in a normal human brain.
Yes. On a normal natural human receptor, an LSD molecule stays stuck in the on position for nearly 4 hours.
4 hours for a single molecule.
That is a massive amount of time for a single molecule to be engaged, continuously firing a signal down into the neuron.
But how did the Wacker team prove it was specifically the lid doing the trapping? Couldn't the LSD molecule just be, I don't know, really sticky?
That is the beautiful part of the experiment. They didn't just guess. They used genetic engineering to create a mutated version of the receptor.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. They specifically altered the DNA sequence to change the amino acids that make up that extracellular loop too, essentially removing the hinges so the lid could not close.
They took the steel grates off the lobby door.
Exactly. And when they applied LSD to these mutated lidless receptors, the residence time plummeted.
How much?
It dropped from 221 minutes down to just about 50 minutes. The molecule cleared out of the receptor much, much faster because there was nothing physically holding it inside.
This kinetic trapping, this microscopic molecular lid, it completely solves the mystery of LSD's legendary, almost unbelievable potency, doesn't it?
It perfectly explains it. LSD is famous for being active in tiny microscopic quantities, specifically microgram doses.
Micrograms, like millionths of a gram.
Yes. A typical standard dose of LSD is between 100 and 200 micrograms. To give you a physical sense of scale, a single grain of table salt weighs roughly 50 micrograms.
That is insane.
So we are talking about ingesting 2 to 4 grains of salt's worth of matter to induce a 12-hour altered state of consciousness.
It seems impossible.
It does, until you understand the structural biology. Because it doesn't take very many molecules to trigger the brain if every single molecule that finds a receptor gets trapped and continues to exert its effect for hours. It's highly, highly efficient.
Whereas psilocin, our polite guest, binds with what they call lower affinity. The receptor doesn't lock it in the same way.
Right. It isn't shaped quite right to trigger that lid to clamp down tightly.
Because it clears out of the receptor faster, you simply need a vastly larger amount of the raw substance circulating in the blood to achieve a sustained psychedelic effect over time.
That is exactly why psilocybin is dosed in milligrams, not micrograms.
Mm-hmm.
A standard clinical dose of psilocybin is typically 15 to 30 milligrams.
So when you compare the two by pure mass, LSD is roughly 100 times more potent than psilocybin.
Yes. And that staggering multiplier is almost entirely due to the structural mechanics of that microscopic loop of amino acids acting as a lid.
Okay, so we have seen the chemistry in a petri dish. We have looked at the crystallized receptors. We know they share a core engine, but we also know LSD is promiscuous with dopamine and gets physically trapped in the serotonin receptor.
Right.
But what happens when you take all this out of the structural biology lab and put these molecules into actual human beings? What happens when you test them in a strictly controlled, rigorous, double-blind environment where the folklore can't influence the outcome?
This is where the science moves from theoretical cellular mechanics to lived human experience, but quantified. And the OOTW article points to what is arguably the definitive modern study comparing the two substances head-to-head in humans.
The Basel Showdown.
Yes, the Basel Showdown.
This was a landmark study published in 2022 by Holtz, Leakdy, and their team at the University Hospital Basel in Switzerland. And the methodology here is just staggering. I want to spend some time on this because they didn't just ask a few people how they felt over the weekend.
Yeah, not at all.
They took 28 healthy adult volunteers and put each of them through five massive 25-hour sessions in a highly controlled hospital setting.
The rigor of the methodology is what makes the conclusion so undeniable. It was a double-blind, placebo-controlled crossover design.
Explain why crossover is the gold standard for this kind of research. Why does that matter?
Well, in a standard trial, you might give group A the drug and group B the placebo. But human brains are so incredibly variable, especially with subjective psychedelics.
Right. Group A might just be more imaginative or anxious people.
Exactly. Group A might just happen to be naturally more visual than group B. A crossover design means every single participant eventually receives every single dose condition over a series of months. They act as their own control.
That is brilliant.
It is. The five conditions in the Basel study were a placebo, a 100 microgram dose of LSD, a 200 microgram dose of LSD, a 15 milligram dose of psilocybin, and a 30 milligram dose of psilocybin.
And double blind means nobody in the room knows what is happening. Not the patients lying in the hospital bed and not the doctors administering the pill.
Right. You don't know if you're getting the electric marathon, the earthy journey, or literally a sugar pill.
Exactly. It completely strips away the expectancy effect. You just receive a capsule. And the findings from this specific study are perhaps the most robust, paradigm-shifting data points in the entire article.
Because they sought to answer a fundamental question.
Yes. If you control for the intensity of the dose, do the experiences actually feel different?
But wait, hold on. I have to push back here. How can they possibly quantify that? How do you mathematically match the intensity of two entirely different subjective experiences in a lab? It sounds like trying to mathematically prove whether a sunset is more intense than a symphony.
It is a profound challenge, I agree. But psychopharmacologists have developed highly validated psychometric tools over decades of research to do exactly that. They don't just ask, you know, how high are you on the scale of 1 to 10?
Right.
They use comprehensive, multidimensional questionnaires, the most prominent being the 5DASC, or the 5-Dimensional Altered States of Consciousness Rating Scale.
So what does that measure? This tool breaks the experience down into dozens of specific metrics. The vividness of geometric patterns, the sense of ego dissolution, feelings of dread, feelings of oceanic boundlessness, altered perception of time, auditory changes.
Patients fill these out at various points.
Yes, throughout the session. And researchers map the score.
So they essentially plot the geometry of the trip on a graph.
In a sense, yes. And by analyzing those complex graphs across 28 people acting as their own controls, they found that a dose of 100 to 200 micrograms of LSD produces an overall peak intensity curve, that is statistically comparable to 30 milligrams of psilocybin.
They found the mathematical equivalency point.
They did.
And once they mathematically matched the intensity, what did they discover about the quality of the trips?
They discovered something shocking. When mathematically matched for intensity, the quality of the altered state barely differs.
Wow. If you're listening to this, let that sink in for a moment. All the debate in that hypothetical room we built at the beginning, all the folklore about fundamentally different types of trips, the cybernetic lab chemical versus the ancient forest mushroom.
Yeah.
When controlled for dose and duration in a blind setting, the qualitative experience is remarkably strikingly alike. The folk intuition of them being completely different animals is mostly wrong.
It forces a massive reframing of how we think about these substances. It tells us that the core 5-HT2A agonism on those layer 5 pyramidal neurons is so phenomenally powerful, so completely dominant in shaping the psychedelic state, that it overrides most of the subtle differences we might expect from LSD's promiscuous binding to dopamine and other receptors.
So the main engine is just too loud?
Exactly. When the core 5-HT2A engine is revving that hard, the differences in the upholstery of the car become secondary. The sheer volume of the serotonin cascade drowns out the subtle whispers of the dopamine activity, at least during the peak of the experience.
However, there is one robust, mathematically undeniable difference that the Basel study highlighted. And it isn't about the nature of the geometric visuals or the profound emotional tone of the ego dissolution. It is simply about time.
Yes.
LSD just asks for roughly twice as much of your day.
The duration data is stark, and it completely validates the structural biology of the receptor lid we discussed earlier. According to the Basel study's pharmacokinetic tracking, the effects of LSD lasted, on average, about 9.3 hours.
9.3 hours.
And psilocybin, on the other hand, had a duration of roughly 5.6 to 6.5 hours.
So the real definitive difference between the two, the one thing you can absolutely take to the bank, is that LSD is a full workday plus a commute, while psilocybin is a long afternoon.
Precisely. Now, it is important to note that the study did find some subtle physiological quirks. While both molecules are physiologically very safe, they have slightly different cardiovascular signatures when they hit the body.
Like what?
Well, psilocybin tended to raise blood pressure more significantly during the onset, whereas LSD tended to raise heart rate more.
Interesting.
The overall cardiovascular strain was comparable in terms of safety, but the specific autonomic mechanisms reacting to the molecules were slightly divergent.
And if we go back to the vibes, if it's just a matter of time, why does the folklore persist so stubbornly? The article does address those softer contrasts that users consistently report, doesn't it?
It does. It acknowledges that even in some controlled settings, patients occasionally report that LSD feels slightly more energetic, which ties perfectly back to that dopamine D2 connection we talked about.
Right.
And it notes that psilocybin is often reported as feeling slightly more physically heavy, with a gentler taper back to baseline. But the crucial instruction from the source material is how to weigh this evidence hierarchy. It explicitly states, trust the duration data implicitly, hold the vibe differences very loosely.
Because those vibe differences might just be a byproduct of the duration. I mean, if I'm in a profoundly altered state for 10 hours instead of 5, I might naturally feel more restless, more energized, or more exhausted simply because it's a marathon.
That is a highly plausible interpretation. The longer you are under, the more the secondary pharmacological effects, like the dopamine stimulation, have time to assert themselves as the primary 5-HT2A peak begins to slowly wane.
That makes sense.
But the core finding holds. The differences are tendencies, they're anecdotes, they're not robustly quantified qualitative differences that consistently define one drug against the other.
Think about how wild that is. Human culture creates these incredibly elaborate myths around subjective experiences. We build entire identities, musical genres, and subcultures around the supposed profound differences between the organic mushroom and the synthetic acid tab.
We really do.
But when you apply rigorous scientific controls, that complex mythology dissolves, and a much simpler truth is revealed. The difference is based almost entirely on the kinetic trapping of a microscopic amino acid lid, which dictates how long the drug lasts.
It is a perfect example of science clarifying rather than diminishing a phenomenon. The reality of a molecular lid is just as wondrous as the folklore, but it has the added benefit of being true. However, the subjective human experience, how the patient feels on the hospital bed, is only one layer of the data. While the outward feeling might just be a matter of time, we have to look deeper.
At the brain itself.
Yes. What is actually happening to the physical networks of the brain when these molecules take hold? If they feel the same, Do the brain scans actually look the same?
Right. If we accept that this tiny molecular lid dictates the trip length and the subjective feelings are mathematically identical, what is physically happening inside the skull during those hours?
It's a chaotic environment.
Let's move from the psychological to the neurological, because this is where the concept of the entropic brain comes into play. To understand this, we first have to introduce a massive concept in neuroscience: the default mode network, or the DMN.
The default mode network is a highly interconnected, sprawling system of brain regions. It includes areas like the medial prefrontal cortex and the posterior cingulate cortex.
And what does it do?
What is fascinating about the DMN is when it is active. It is most active when you're doing absolutely nothing.
Wait, really?
Yeah. When you are not focused on a task in the outside world, when you are daydreaming, thinking about the past, planning for the future, and crucially, thinking about yourself.
So it's the brain's self-referential system. It's essentially the neurological seat of your ego, the internal autobiography module that constantly reminds you of who you are, what your problems are, what you regret, and how you fit into the social hierarchy around you.
That is exactly what it is. It is a high-level control system. It acts as an orchestrator, keeping your consciousness orderly, constrained, and focused on survival and social cohesion.
Okay.
Now, when neuroscientists put human subjects into fMRI scanners, which track blood flow and network activity in real time, while they're under the influence of either LSD or psilocybin, they see something dramatic happen to the default mode network.
What happens?
Both drugs acutely reduce the integrity and the within-network connectivity of the DMN.
They collapse it. The rigid structure of the ego networks basically disintegrates.
Yes. The regions of the brain that normally fire together to maintain your sense of self stop communicating synchronously. And as the DMN collapses, a model proposed by neuroscientist Robin Carhart-Harris in 2014 takes over. It's called the entropic brain model.
Entropy is a physics term, right? It's a measure of disorder or chaos in a system. How does that apply to the brain?
Well, in the context of the brain, raising neural entropy means breaking down the usual strict hierarchical control systems like the DMN and allowing for vastly more chaotic, unconstrained neural firing.
It's like, okay, it's like taking a snow globe that has been sitting perfectly still on a shelf.
Okay.
Where all the snow has settled neatly at the bottom into a structured landscape, and then violently shaking it. The settled, organized landscape is suddenly thrown into a state of chaotic, highly connected flux.
A very apt metaphor. And as that hierarchical control is flattened by the drug, what you see on the fMRI scans is a massive boost in cross-network connectivity.
The brain talking to itself in new ways.
Yes. Regions of the brain that normally never speak directly to each other, because the default mode network usually acts as a strict bureaucratic middleman, filtering everything, suddenly start communicating directly.
Wow.
The visual cortex starts talking to the auditory cortex. Mm-hmm. The emotion centers start directly feeding into the memory centers without the ego filtering the data.
This hyperconnected entropic state is the accepted neural correlate of what users describe subjectively as ego dissolution, right?
It is.
That terrifying or beautiful feeling of losing the boundary between the self and the universe. That feeling that you are the room or you are the music.
Yes.
That is literally your brain's self-referencing network going offline, allowing sensory and emotional data to flow unconstrained across the entire brain without an eye to claim ownership of it.
And this incredible entropic state happens profoundly with both molecules. However, the advanced multimodal imaging does capture a few tiny drug-specific nuances.
Like what?
With LSD, the scans show a particularly stark increase in visual cortex whole brain integration. The visual processing centers at the back of the brain become highly integrated with the rest of the brain's networks, which strongly drives the intense, pervasive visual imagery associated with LSD.
And for psilocybin, the source notes a fascinating correlation about the timing of the collapse.
Yes. The degree to which that default mode network disintegrates perfectly tracks with the plasma levels of psilocin in the blood.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. As the drug concentration in your bloodstream peaks, the network collapse in your brain peaks, and as the liver clears the drug, the network reassembles itself precisely in tandem. It's an incredibly tight, predictable dose-response relationship.
But the acute effects, the ego dissolution, the intense visual integration, the entropic chaos, those are transient. They happen while the drug is physically sitting in the receptor. The snow globe eventually settles, as you said.
Right, it always settles.
What has the scientific and medical community truly energized right now is not the trip itself. It is what happens after the drug leaves the system entirely. The physical, enduring changes to the brain's architecture.
This is a monumental shift in how we view these compounds. We are moving from discussing altered states of consciousness to discussing rapid neuroplasticity.
Neuroplasticity.
Yes. We aren't just talking about changing your mind conceptually. We're talking about literally changing the physical structure of your brain tissue.
To explore this, the article cites a pivotal 2021 study by Shao et al. Done on living mice. And the methodology and the data here are just wild. I mean, how do you even look at the physical structure of a living brain?
The researchers used a highly advanced technique called two-photon imaging.
Two-photon imaging?
Yeah. They essentially create a tiny transparent window in the skull of a living anesthetized mouse.
Oh, a literal window.
A literal window. They then use specialized lasers that can penetrate deep into the living tissue to look directly at the microscopic structure of individual neurons in the frontal cortex while the animal is alive.
That is incredible.
It is. So they gave these mice a single dose of psilocybin, and then they watched.
What did they see through the window?
Within 24 hours of that single dose, they observed a roughly 10% increase in the size and density of dendritic spines on those cortical neurons.
Okay, let's explain what a dendritic spine is for anyone who hasn't taken a neurobiology class recently.
Sure.
If we imagine a neuron as a tree, the dendrites are the long branches that reach out to connect with other trees in the forest. The dendritic spines would be like little buds or leaves popping out on those branches, right?
Yes, exactly.
Those buds are where the actual synaptic connections, the handshakes between brain cells, are made.
Precisely. So a 10% increase in spine size and density means the brain is literally growing new connections, physically expanding its capacity to communicate, learn, and adapt.
Within 24 hours.
Within 24 hours. And crucially, this wasn't a fleeting effect that vanished when the drug wore off. In the Shao study, that structural growth, those new branches and buds, persisted for about a month after that single dose.
So we can look through a laser window and know it happens, but how? How does turning that 5-HT2A lock cause a physical tree branch to grow in the brain within a day? The expert source provides an absolute alphabet soup of molecular biology to explain the cascade. Can we translate this into plain English?
We can definitely break down the pathway step by step. The classic psychedelics, LSD, psilocybin, and even DMT all seem to trigger structural growth, which scientists call neurotogenesis or spinogenesis.
Okay.
The entire cascade starts at the 5-HT2A receptor. When that receptor is activated by the drug, it triggers complex intracellular signaling pathways.
A microscopic domino effect inside the body of the cell.
Yes, exactly. The drug hits the outside of the cell and the inside of the cell reacts. One key domino in this sequence is known as MTR signaling.
Yeah.
Yes. MTR is a central ancient regulator of cell growth and metabolism in mammals.
Mm-hmm.
When it gets activated, it tells the cell it is time to build.
Trying to grow.
Right. Another critical component in this cascade is BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor.
BDNF. I've heard this described as miracle grow for the brain.
That is exactly how neuroscientists describe it. BDNF is a specialized protein that explicitly promotes the survival of existing neurons and strongly encourages the growth and differentiation of new synapses and dendrites. The 5-HT2A activation signals the cell to release more of this BDNF.
And there's a specific receptor for this Miracle-Gro protein, right? Called TRKB.
Correct. The released BDNF binds to the TRKB receptor, which then supercharges this physical growth process. But the science gets even deeper here.
How so?
There is a very recent research cited in the article from 2023 suggesting these psychedelic molecules might not just rely on the 5-HT2A domino effect. They might actually be capable of penetrating the cell membrane and binding to the TRKB receptor directly from the inside, essentially acting as a direct biological fertilizer.
So they hit the main switch on the outside and then slip inside to hit the growth switch directly.
It appears that way. And this isn't just happening in mice. The source notes that even in humans, administering low-dose LSD acutely and significantly raises the blood levels of BDNF.
If you're listening to this and wondering why billions of dollars are suddenly pouring into psychedelic research, this is why. This intense burst of molecular fertilizer, this rapid neuroplasticity, provides the fundamental biological foundation for why these drugs have such massive therapeutic potential.
It's the physical proof.
The prevailing theory is that they aren't just masking symptoms like traditional daily antidepressants might. They're physically rewiring a brain that might be rigidly stuck in entrenched physical patterns of depression, anxiety, or trauma. They shake the snow globe psychologically, and then they apply Miracle-Grow so the snow settles in a new, healthier landscape.
It is currently the leading candidate mechanism for explaining the incredible therapeutic durability we're seeing in trials.
Yeah.
Although we should note, as the source strictly does, that definitively proving the causal chain from microscopic spine growth in a mouse directly to clinical mood benefit in a living human patient remains an incredibly complex scientific inference.
So it's still an inference at this point.
Right. We see the physical growth and we separately see the psychological healing, but explicitly proving that one strictly solely causes the other in humans is still the frontier of the research.
Which is the perfect bridge to our next section. With these profound physical neural changes mapped out, how is the medical, clinical, and legal establishment in the year 2026 actually handling these two incredibly powerful tools?
It's a complicated landscape.
Because if they both trigger the exact same neuroplasticity, you would think they would be moving through the FDA approval process at the exact same speed.
Right.
But there is a clear frontrunner.
There is a massive disparity. While both molecules share the exact same mechanism of action for neuroplasticity and therapeutic potential, they are on very different timelines in the clinical approval pipeline. Psilocybin is undeniably significantly further along in the medical race.
Why is that? What does the clinical landscape look like right now in July 2026?
The clinical vanguard for psilocybin is a company called Compass Pathways. They are utilizing a proprietary, highly regulated synthetic formulation of psilocybin known as Q1P360.
Q1P360, okay.
And they have focused heavily on treating treatment-resistant depression, or TRD. This is a severe form of depression where patients have failed to respond to multiple traditional medications.
That's a very difficult condition to treat.
Extremely difficult. But according to the July 2026 data in the article, Compass has successfully hit their primary endpoints in two massive pivotal phase 3 trials.
Phase 3 is the final definitive hurdle before a drug goes to the FDA for formal commercial approval, right?
Yes, it is the make or break stage. The first trial, COMP005, concluded in June 2025, utilizing a single 25 milligram dose of their synthetic psilocybin. The second, COMP006, reported its top line data in February 2026.
And how big was that one?
This was a massive undertaking, involving nearly 600 patients, comparing two 25-milligram doses against a negligible 1-milligram control dose.
And what were the results?
The results showed highly significant efficacy beating the control at week 6, with therapeutic durability stretching out to 26 weeks after just those two doses.
26 weeks of relief from two doses.
Yes. Because of this overwhelming data, an NDA, a new drug application, is anticipated to be filed imminently.
They're basically knocking on the FDA's door with a finished product.
They are.
Now compare that to LSD. Where is acid in the pipeline?
The primary clinical push for LSD is coming from a company called MindMed, utilizing their specific Lyser guide formulation called MM120. They are focused on slightly different indications: generalized anxiety disorder, or GAD, and major depressive disorder, MDD. MindMed actually received FDA breakthrough therapy designation for GAD after a very strong phase 2B trial that showed roughly 65% clinical response and 48% remission sustained out to 12 weeks.
Breakthrough therapy designation is a big deal. It means the FDA recognizes the drug could be vastly superior to current treatments and wants to expedite it.
It is a massive validation. But currently, in mid-2026, their pivotal phase 3 trials, which are named Voyage and Panorama for anxiety and Emerge for depression, are still ongoing. Top-line data is expected to read out slowly through the rest of 2026.
So they are moving fast, they have the FDA's attention, but they are definitively trailing psilocybin by a significant margin.
Yes, they are behind.
But let's dig into the why. Why did the pharmaceutical industry seemingly put all its initial weight and funding behind psilocybin first? I mean, LSD was synthesized in 1938. It has been studied for decades longer in the mid-20th century. We have mountains of historical data on it.
We do.
If we connect this back to part 3 of our discussion, the Basel showdown comparing the two, the answer for why psilocybin is winning the race becomes purely pragmatic and economic, doesn't it?
It comes down almost entirely to the duration.
Ah, the molecular lid again.
Exactly. Psilocybin's 5 to 6 hour clinical session is vastly more practical for a healthcare model than LSD's 9 to 12 hour session. You have to remember how these drugs are administered.
It's not a take-home pill.
No, absolutely not. Supervised in-clinic dosing requires two trained therapists in the room with the patient for the entire duration of the acute pharmacological effects to ensure safety and provide psychological support.
Paying two highly trained psychiatric professionals to sit in a quiet room for 12 hours for a single LSD session is an absolute economic nightmare for an insurance company or a healthcare system.
It's just not viable.
It monopolizes a clinic room for an entire day for one patient. But a five-hour psilocybin session, that can be neatly fit into a standard workday. It more than halves the labor costs and doubles the clinic throughput.
Exactly. That tiny biological quirk, the simple lack of the molecular lid trapping the psilocybin in the receptor, is exactly what makes it a viable, scalable pharmaceutical product in a modern medical economy.
That is wild.
It's a fascinating intersection of microscopic structural biology dictating macro-level healthcare economics.
But of course, with any medical treatment, especially ones that cause ego dissolution and entropic brain states, we have to talk about risk.
Yeah.
So what does this all mean regarding actual physical danger? The folklore often implies these are physically dangerous drugs that can fry your brain or cause you to overdose.
The source material is very explicit and very clear here. It's important to reassure anyone listening that in terms of physiological toxicity, both of these classic psychedelics have incredibly low risk profiles.
Okay.
The margin of safety, which is the ratio between an active therapeutic dose and a physically dangerous or lethal dose, is extraordinarily wide.
How wide are we talking?
Wide enough that there is no known lethal overdose resulting from the direct pharmacological action of either molecule, atypical, or even extremely heavy recreational doses.
Wow, none.
None. The receptors they target simply do not control respiratory drive or critical life support functions in the brainstem, unlike opioids, for example.
Right, which depress your breathing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Furthermore, they are not physically addictive. They don't cause physical withdrawal symptoms. And your body builds a rapid, almost immediate tolerance to them, which practically prevents compulsive daily abuse.
So you literally can't take them every day.
If you take LSD 3 days in a row, by the third day, the receptor simply ignores it.
So you can't realistically overdose and you can't get physically hooked. The physical risks are essentially limited to those modest, transient increases in heart rate or blood pressure we mentioned earlier.
Yes.
But that absolutely does not mean they are harmless or risk-free.
Far from it. The real risks, as the article heavily emphasizes, are entirely psychological. The dominant real-world danger is profound psychological destabilization, often categorized broadly as a challenging trip.
The bad trip.
Right. This can manifest as acute anxiety, sheer panic, or deep conceptual confusion during the experience. This risk is heavily modulated by set and setting the user's internal mindset and the external physical environment.
Which is exactly why the clinical models rely so heavily on rigorous pre-screening, hours of preparation therapy, and integration therapy afterward. You don't just hand someone a pill and wish them luck.
Precisely. And there is a very firm medical contraindication uniformly mentioned across the literature. Anyone with a personal or family history of psychotic disorders, such as schizophrenia or bipolar disorder with mania, is strictly screened out of these clinical treatments.
Why is that?
The intense entropic brain state carries a known risk of triggering a latent psychotic episode or exacerbating existing instability in those specific vulnerable populations.
That makes perfect sense. We also need to address a specific condition that comes up often in the folklore, HPPD, or hallucinogen persisting perception disorder.
Ah, yes, HPPD. This is a recognized psychiatric condition where individuals experience lingering perceptual changes, often visual anomalies like halos, trails, or visual static, long after the drug has completely cleared their physical system.
Right. And the folklore online makes HPPD sound like an inevitability if you take enough psychedelics. But what does the hard data say about the frequency?
The data shows it is actually quite rare. The chronic impairing form of HPPD, where it significantly disrupts daily life, is estimated to occur in roughly 1 in 50,000 users.
1 in 50,000.
Yes. It is a real risk, but statistically very small. However, what is highly relevant to our comparison today is a 2022 study by Miller et al. Cited in the article. This study looked at the population of people who do report these long-term perceptual changes, and they found a stark disparity.
What was the disparity?
A significantly higher percentage of sufferers attribute their HPPD to LSD, about 39% of cases, compared to psilocybin, which accounts for only about 11%.
Wait, why would there be a disparity? If they run the exact same 5-HT2A engine and they cause the exact same neuroplasticity, why does a lab chemical carry nearly four times the risk of lasting visual static?
The leading hypothesis brings us right back to our central theme, duration.
Ah, the 12 hours versus 5 hours.
Exactly.
Yep.
LSD's much longer duration means a much longer protracted window of acute neuroplasticity and network disruption. It provides a significantly greater opportunity for a difficult psychological experience to unfold, and crucially, it potentially provides a larger window for the highly complex visual processing pathways to become slightly persistently misaligned as they attempt to reorganize.
So it's basically just giving the brain more time to make a mistake while it's rewiring.
Simply put, leaving the system in a state of high entropy for 12 hours carries a higher baseline risk of a glitch than doing it for 5 hours. Psilocybin's shorter arc is generally considered easier to manage, both clinically by the therapists and psychologically by the patient.
So if we look at the whole board, we have two profound, structurally similar, physiologically non-toxic, but psychologically powerful molecules. One is nearing FDA approval, the other is in late-stage trials. How does the law reflect this medical reality in 2026?
The legal landscape is a stark, fascinating patchwork of absolute contradictions. At the federal level in the United States, absolutely nothing has changed. Both psilocybin and LSD remain strictly Schedule I under the Controlled Substances Act.
Schedule I means the federal government officially considers them to have no accepted medical use whatsoever and a high potential for abuse.
Exactly.
Despite the FDA literally granting both of them breakthrough therapy status for major psychiatric disorders, the contradiction is glaring and almost comical.
It is a massive bureaucratic paradox. But the state level is where the paths of these two molecules radically diverge, mirroring their cultural reputations.
State-level reform is where psilocybin has completely broken away from LSD. As of 2026, psilocybin has established regulated adult access frameworks in two key states.
Right, Oregon and Colorado.
Yes, Oregon, through Measure 109, licenses specific service centers where adults can legally consume psilocybin under the direct supervision of a state-trained facilitator. Colorado, through Proposition 122, went further. They decriminalized personal use and established licensed healing centers for supervised administration.
And Colorado's law is particularly interesting because it actually covers several natural psychedelics. It includes psilocybin, but also DMT, ibogaine, and mescaline. Do you notice what is noticeably missing from that comprehensive state legalization list?
LSD is entirely excluded from both the Oregon and Colorado regulated frameworks. It has zero state legal access anywhere in the United States outside of a clinical trial.
None whatsoever.
Even though a federal executive order was issued on April 18, 2026, directing federal agencies to rapidly accelerate research into all of these compounds, including LSD, it confirmed absolutely no actual legalization, rescheduling, or legal access.
It highlights a persistent, deeply ingrained cultural bias. Psilocybin, being derived directly from a natural mushroom, heavily benefits from a plant medicine halo in the eyes of state voters and legislators.
Right. It feels ancient, natural, and safe.
Exactly. LSD, being a semi-synthetic compound created in a Swiss laboratory in the 1930s, still carries the heavy, dark stigma of the 1960s counterculture. It is perceived by voters as a harder, more dangerous, or more synthetic drug, despite the rigorous neuroscience proving unequivocally that they operate via the exact same core mechanisms, induce the same plasticity, and share highly comparable safety profiles.
It is the ultimate triumph of folklore over pharmacology in the realm of public policy. The molecule from the dirt gets legalized, the molecule from the lab gets banned, even though they turn the exact same key in the brain.
Indeed.
Yeah.
It goes to show that while the brain doesn't care about the folklore, society absolutely does.
We have covered a tremendous amount of ground today, from the depths of the cortex to the halls of the FDA. Let's summarize the core takeaways.
Yeah, let's wrap this up.
If you remember absolutely nothing else from this deep dive, remember this. The popular idea that psilocybin and LSD are completely different animals offering fundamentally different types of experiences is largely a myth.
A very persistent myth.
They share the same 5-HT2A engine. They cause the exact same entropic collapse of the default mode network. They induce the exact same structural neuroplasticity and dendritic spine growth.
Exactly.
The one honest, chemically robust, mathematically proven difference is simply how long you want the door left open. Do you want a 4 to 6 hour journey or a 9 to 12 hour marathon?
Understanding this precise neuroscience does something vital for us as a society. It strips away the fear, the mysticism, and the unhelpful, sometimes dangerous folklore that has surrounded these compounds for decades. It replaces that noisy mythology with absolute clarity, leaving us with precise, predictable, and profoundly powerful medical tools for addressing some of the most intractable mental health crises of our time.
But before we sign off, I want to leave you with a final provocative thought to mull over. Something that builds entirely on the structural biology we've discussed today, but looks slightly past the current 2026 reality.
Oh, this is the exciting part.
We've established that the only truly robust difference between these two profound states is the duration of the trip. And we know that duration is dictated entirely by a microscopic amino acid lid on a receptor kinetically trapping the molecule.
Right.
If that is true, what happens when neuropharmacologists stop relying on nature and start relying on 1930s Swiss chemistry and start designing completely synthetic psychedelics from scratch?
Which is already starting to happen.
Could we soon see a designer psychedelic molecule engineered by supercomputers to slip perfectly under that lid, provide the exact massive therapeutic neuroplasticity and ego dissolution of an LSD trip, but chemically designed to be metabolized out of the human system in exactly 45 minutes.
Wow.
A profound, reality-altering therapeutic intervention, perfectly timed to fit into a standard lunch break therapy session.
Given the rapid pace of structural biology and AI-driven drug discovery, it is absolutely the next logical frontier of the science.
Something to think about as you navigate the changing landscape of mental health. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Stay curious, keep questioning the folklore, and we'll see you next time.